This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Douglas Impoga, and here's what's coming up.
The service said the unwarranted standoff witnessed on Monday in Nairobi and Kisumu in an illegal demonstration amounts to nothing short of violence against police and economic sabotage.
That's reporter Mariama Diallo quoting from a Nairobi Police Service statement defending its actions in dealing with the protesters yesterday that human rights advocates condemned as barbaric acts. Also, Ghana says illegal weapons are being smuggled in from Burkina Faso. Niger says it negotiated the release of two foreign hostages who were held captive for years in the Sahel region. And countries burdened with debt and losses from weather-related events have agreed to consider swapping debt to invest in climate action. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Human rights advocates in Kenya are condemning what they call barbaric acts by police in their response to protests over the high cost of living. One university student was killed, 31 officers were injured, and nearly 240 people arrested yesterday in demonstrations organized by opposition leader Raila Odinga. VOA's Mariama Diallo has more from Nairobi on protests there and elsewhere in Kenya.
In a joint statement, the Kenya Human Rights Commission, along with the Constitution and Reform Education Consortium and Muslims for Human Rights, say the violent and excessive use of force and restriction of movement by the Kenyan police was uncalled for. News reports say that a student from Maseno University in the western city of Kisumu was killed when officers fired live rounds during skirmishes with protesters. On Tuesday, students took to the streets in Kisumu to protest his death, according to local reports. Separately, the National Police Service says that even after officers restrained themselves and acted according to the law, rioters stormed the Maseno police station, hurling stones at officers and property. The NPS also says that 10 police vehicles were damaged during Monday's protests. Interior Cabinet Secretary Kithure Kindiki praised the police service, which he said had done the country proud despite the day-long provocation by unruly protesters. In Nairobi Monday, police fired tear gas at opposition leader Raila Odinga's convoy and used water cannons to disperse the crowds as he spoke to supporters from the sunroof of his car in the city's Eastleigh area. Asked for comments on the protest, the NPS referred VOA to a statement released Tuesday. The service said the unwarranted standoff witnessed on Monday in Nairobi and Kisumu in an illegal demonstration amounts to nothing short of violence against police and economic sabotage. The demonstrations were organized by Odinga, who said the high cost of staples such as maize flour was one of the reasons he called for the protest. Odinga narrowly lost to President William Ruto in last year's election. The longtime opposition leader has called for the protest to be repeated every Monday and Thursday. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
The government of Niger says it negotiated the release of a French journalist and a U.S. aid worker who were held captive by Islamic militants in the Sahel region. Reporter Olivier Dubois spent nearly 2 years in captivity, while aid worker and missionary Jeffrey Woodke was held for more than 6 years. Annika Hammerschlag speaks to security analysts on the significance of their release in this report from Dakar, Senegal.
Kidnappings in the Sahel are growing at an alarming rate. Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger saw a combined 532 abductions in 2002, up from 33 in 2017, according to the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project. Some 115 people have already been abducted in the region this year. Fahira Menkone is a security analyst with the Institute for Security Studies in Dakar. Kidnappings in the Sahel represent a permanent risk for all actors working in the region, he said.
C'est une pratique qui a été mise en avant depuis longtemps par les groupes djihadistes.
He says this is a practice that has been put forward for a long time by jihadist groups as a method of financing, but also by other ransom groups who simply engage in banditry. Due to the private nature of hostage negotiations, it's difficult to decipher the role each country plays in securing someone's release, Kone said. Niger's efforts, however, should not go unnoticed, he added. Niger, nevertheless, stands out more and more in the Central Sahel in its approach to the fight against insecurity, he says. While in Burkina Faso and Mali, we see a strengthening of the militarized approach to the fight, he says, Niger is trying to set forth a policy of negotiation so as to disengage fighters from groups and to negotiate with jihadist leaders themselves. While abductions of foreigners often make headlines, the majority of kidnappings target locals. Some 97% of civilians abducted in Mali since 2012 were Malian, according to a 2021 report from the Institute for Security Studies. Local humanitarian workers, village chiefs, religious leaders, and journalists are among the most targeted groups. Sedi Boumerang is the West Africa director for Reporters Without Borders. People must not forget Malian journalists Amadou Niaboli and Moussa Mbanadiko, who are still being held captive, he said. The safe return of Dubois shows that hostage release campaigns can be successful, he added.
When people generally think it's not possible, we need to try to go far and wide. It's always possible to set up mechanisms to advocate, to mobilize allies everywhere so as to achieve such a positive result.
Dubois was kidnapped on April 8, 2021, in Mali's northern Gao region by the Group for the Support of Islam and Muslims, or JNIM, a coalition of jihadist insurgent groups active in the Sahel. He was there to interview a jihadist leader when he was abducted. In a video posted to Twitter from the Niamey airport Monday, he told reporters he was tired but felt fine. It's huge for me to be here, to be free, he says. I'd like to acknowledge Niger and their expertise with this sensitive mission. And to France as well, to everyone that allowed me to be here today, he added. Dubois returned to Paris Tuesday, where he was greeted by President Emmanuel Macron. U.S. aid worker Jeffrey Woodkey was kidnapped in October 2016 from his home in Abalak, Niger, and is believed to have been taken to Mali. Niger's interior minister said Nigerian authorities secured his release from JNIM. Via Twitter, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said he was gratified and relieved over Woodkey's liberation and thanked Niger for its help in securing the aid worker's release. The releases follow a recent trip to Niger by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
African countries burdened with debt and losses from weather-related events, including drought and flooding, have agreed to consider swapping debt to invest in climate action. The move took place at a UN-backed meeting of finance ministers in the Ethiopian capital. Ethiopia is looking to boost funds to help nations and local communities fight damage from high temperatures. The AP explains that the burden for climate swap option allows debt to be reduced in exchange for commitments to green investment. Finance ministers said high interest rates and external debt, which takes up 17% of some countries' spending, prevent some governments from funding climate change measures. The AP says ministers also discussed bonds that would help private financial flows, as well as models that could combine public and private capital to provide climate funding. Meanwhile, Morocco's Royal Palace asked the largest Islamist party, the PJD, to stop taking aim at the country's ties with Israel after the party rebuked the foreign minister for defending Israel at the expense of Palestinians. Renewed violence between Israelis and Palestinians poses a challenge to Arab countries that have normalized ties with Israel. Eli Abouon, director of NEMA programs at the U.S. Institute of Peace, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shanawi how Israeli actions against the Palestinians complicate the normalization process, especially the Abraham Accords that were sponsored by the Trump administration.
I don't think that the accords themselves are at risk. I don't see any risk on the survival of the accords themselves. However, it's worth mentioning that all the countries who signed peace treaties or agreements or whatever, accords with Israel, were not able to convince their public opinion that this is the best way forward. Egypt is the first country who ventured into this kind of peace treaty with Israel. And in Egypt, we can definitely see that the majority of Egyptians are not really supportive of this peace treaty, and they don't. Same applies to Jordan. Obviously, in the case of Morocco and UAE, I think the public opinion or the population in general feels still more solidarity with the Palestinians than being supportive of the Abraham Accord. So this is a classical reaction that we've seen in other countries as well. So I don't think Morocco is an exception in this regard. I think that the king, he expected that his population will not follow through. However, this does not mean that the commitment of Morocco as a country, as a government, to the accord is at risk, as I said. So there needs to be more strategic communication and public diplomacy within Morocco to make sure that the grievances of the public opinion or the objections of the public opinion do not come in the way of Morocco continuing to be part of the Abraham Accord. Yes, I can see why the palace is sensitive about any other personality dealing with foreign affairs. It has been always the case that the palace leads on foreign affairs in Morocco, and I think that they will continue to insist that this is how things should be done. So at that level, I don't see any change that is possible. The key, as I said before, the key challenge remains how to convince the population that this is the best way to deal with Israel in general. And of course, the more tension we see inside Israel with the Palestinians and in the Palestinian territories, the more difficult will be the task of convincing the Arab populations that they need to accept normalization with Israel and peace treaties with Israel. So it's a vicious circle, basically. But I think the Abraham Accord will remain there. I don't see them being at risk because of what's happening.
Well, the Moroccan Royal Palace said that foreign policy was a prerogative of the king and it would not be subject to blackmail. However, critics argue that King Mohammed VI is heading the Jerusalem Committee that aims at protecting the Palestinian rights. How could the king deal with the Moroccan popular support for the Palestinian people against the Abraham Accords?
I can see why the palace is sensitive about any other personality dealing with foreign affairs. It has been always the case that the palace leads on foreign affairs in Morocco, and I think that they will continue to insist that this is how things should be done. So at that level, I don't see any change that is possible. The key, as I said before, the key challenge remains how to convince the population that this is the best way to deal with Israel in general. And of course, the more tension we see inside Israel with the Palestinians and in the Palestinian territories, the more difficult will be the task of convincing the Arab populations that they need to accept normalization with Israel and peace treaties with Israel. So it's a vicious circle, basically. But I think the Abraham Accord will remain there. I don't see them being at risk because of what's happening.
That was Eli Aboun, director of MENA programs at the U.S. Institute of Peace, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El Shanawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. Ethiopia's government has rejected a U.S. assertion that all sides in the two-year Tigray war committed war crimes, calling the statement inflammatory. Maya Miskel reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Monday on Twitter that the Ethiopian and Eritrean armies, Amhara region forces, and Tigray People's Liberation Front forces all committed atrocity crimes during the Tigray war that ended in November. Blinken said he condemns these atrocities and welcomes commitments to pursue transitional justice. Ethiopia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs struck back in a statement Tuesday, saying it rejects the U.S. allegation that all sides committed war crimes during the Tigray conflict. It said Blinken's statement, coming a week after the Secretary of State visited Ethiopia, unfairly proportions blame and is inflammatory and untimely. The government said it has just launched national consultations on a transitional justice policy. The ministry added that a report on human rights released by the U.S. State Department on Monday does not contain any information that wasn't included in a previous joint report done by the UN and Ethiopia's Human Rights Commission. In a separate report released by the UN last September, investigators had found evidence of crimes against humanity by the Ethiopian government, including using starvation as a weapon. The government rejected that report. Maya Msikir for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Hussein Kiflu, a political and social commentator, tells me that the Ethiopian government should accept responsibility and try to restore its strategic relationship with the United States.
When it comes to the State Department's statement about war crimes and crimes against humanity, it's timely and it's accurate, except lacking one element, because I believe when you see the definition of genocide, the Abiy Ahmed's regime, in conjunction with his partner in crime, Isaias Afwerki of Eritrea, they have committed a genocide in Tigray. So apart from that element missing in the State Department's Antony Blinken's statement, everything that has been said about war crime and crimes against humanity is accurate. The response, like I said, from Abiy Ahmed's regime, it's typical.
But the Ethiopian government points out that such apportioning of blame is unwarranted and undercuts support of the U.S. for an inclusive peace process in Ethiopia. How does that one factor in?
The way they say that apportioning blame and it's one-sided, the State Department has also leveled accusation against TPLF. It's not only against the Eritrean regime and the Ethiopian regime that they have leveled this accusation. They have also blamed TPLF. So it's unacceptable what the regime in Addis Ababa is saying. Once again, a refusal to accept responsibility, and now accountability is glaring them in the face. How they would bring them to the book, that's what I'm curious to see.
Yeah. In the same statement by the Ethiopian government, they say that despite all this, Ethiopia hoped its strategic relationship with the U.S. Would be restored, which is, of course, also the intention of the U.S. government. Now, despite this back and forth, how do you see this affecting the relationship?
I think that is the reason that the State Department avoided accusing the Abiy Ahmed's regime of genocide. They want to, in fact, when Antony Blinken went to Addis Ababa, Abiy Ahmed's regime, in a matter of protocol, they rebuffed him. You know, that he was supposed to be received, according to protocol, by the foreign minister of Ethiopia. But they sent some junior officer to receive him at the airport. And it tells you that on one hand, they want to have this good relationship with the United States because they are really in need of foreign currency. The economy is in shambles. So they need the United States to back them up financially. Russia cannot do that. China is certainly reluctant to do that. So on the one hand, they want to have this relationship with the United States. On the other hand, the Abiy Ahmed's regime is so immature that the United States government has a lot of accountability. The government has to answer to the public whenever it helps foreign regimes like Abiy Ahmed. So they do things, with some degree of responsibility. They cannot just bail out any government with which they want to have strategic relationship. So I think the United States government, the State Department, balanced that. As you know, in the Horn of Africa, it's a very, very volatile region. So the way I see it, Washington doesn't want to lose allies from the Horn of Africa. They want to deal with these things very, very carefully. But Abiy Ahmed's regime is not giving them that chance.
That was Hussein Kiflu, a political and social commentator. He spoke with me from Dallas, Texas. The Basketball Africa League Sahara Conference is wrapping up, so we are joined now in studio by my colleague, Sane Young. Sane, great to have you, Sane.
Sporty greetings, Douglas. Great to be back on Africa News tonight.
Thank you. Now, let's take a look at the standings, Sane.
Well, heading into Tuesday's games, Douglas, at the Dakar Arena in Senegal, Abidjan Basketball Club, also known as the ABC Fighters from Ivory Coast, they topped the table with 3 wins and 1 loss. Defending BAL champion U.S. Monastir from Tunisia, they also have 3 wins and 1 loss. They're in second position. And Rwanda Energy Group, they're in third position with 3 wins and 2 losses. Those three teams are through to the BAL playoffs in May in Kigali, Rwanda. The interesting position is number four. That's still up for grabs, Douglas. And it's going to be either AS Douala, that's the local team from Dakar, Senegal, or Stade Malien. And if we take a look at Tuesday's games, Stade Malien of Mali is playing the ABC Fighters, and that will be followed by a game between AS Douala and Monastir. So that fourth position is the one still to be determined, Douglas.
So in other words, Sunny, what are the implications of the games that are being played today?
Well, if AS Douala and Stade Malien both win their games today, AS Douala would go through to the playoffs based on having defeated Stade Malien in an earlier game.
The Sahara Conference is almost over, Sunny. Now, what are you looking forward to watch in the Nile Conference?
Well, I'm looking forward to checking out one of the teams from your country, Douglas, Uganda.
Yes.
City Oilers. I don't know a lot about them, but I know they're based in Kampala, and they'll be making their debut in the Basketball Africa League. The Cape Town Tigers, they have returned to play in the BAL, and they have recruited Zaire Wade. He is the son of Dwayne Wade, the former NBA star. And so I think Zaire is going to attract a lot of attention. So those are two teams I'm looking forward to seeing. Another team making its debut in the Nile Conference, Al Ahly from Egypt. So some interesting teams that we'll be watching in Cairo, Egypt, for the Nile Conference.
And the Rwanda team, of course, will have home advantage.
Good point. Good point, Douglas. They know that BK Arena in Kigali very well. And I expect, President Kagame will show his support for Rwanda Energy Group and come out and watch that team play, since his country will once again be hosting the BAL playoffs and final. And I think that is really kind of an endorsement by the BAL of what Rwanda has done on the sporting front.
Indeed, Kagame is a very big sports fan, so I'm not surprised.
And if we just look back a few days, Douglas, they hosted the FIFA Congress at the same BK Arena.
And I saw him play.
So, yes, he is a big sports fan, and I think he'll be turning up to watch that the playoffs come May.
Thanks very much, Sunny. We'll keep watch. Many Libyan consumers preparing to fast for Ramadan are planning to cut back on a national passion, espresso. The French news agency AFP says observant Muslims everywhere are expected to refrain during the holy month from eating and drinking from dawn till dusk. Men in Tripoli, with kiosks and cafes dotted with espresso machines, told the news service that fasting won't keep their passion for caffeine from brewing. One shopper said, "We spend the whole day dreaming about the coffee we are going to drink." The AFP notes that Libyans have been drinking coffee since the 15th century, as beans from Yemen made their way through North Africa to Europe. Italy's occupation of Libya in the early 20th century replaced cardamom-tinted Arabic coffee with punch, espressos, and macchiatos, some in small but prized Taza cups. Caffeine lovers say just before nightfall, coffee will be on every iftar table, even if it's decaf. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yabro, and our engineer tonight, Zainab Abdulrahman, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.